After our sermon last Sunday, I hope that all of us now realize that when we read, for example, John chapter 3 and verse 16, that God so loved the world, that that word for love is a very different term than the one that we are accustomed to using before we become a Christian and still continue to use after we become a Christian. The nature of love went through a tremendous change after man fell into sin. Selfishness became the main purpose for the existence of every man and woman who was born into the world and rejected God and simply wanted to live to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. As a result of that, love went through a terrible metamorphosis from a giving emotion to a sometimes giving emotion and other times taking emotion. And unfortunately, for most of us, we have been loved by human beings who are sometimes selfish and sometimes unselfish. When they are unselfish, their love, their generosity is wonderful. But when they fall into selfishness or anger or bitterness or rudeness, then we become the brunt of the whatever they choose to do or whatever they choose to say. I wanted to elaborate a little bit more on the concepts behind the agape love. And to do that, I wanted to bring up another lexicon, this one much more extensive than the other one. I want to read this to you, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. Basically, there are three expressions for love in pre-biblical Greek. Eron, philein, and agapen. Eron, in every age, the Greeks sung glowing hymns to sensually joyous Eros. Now, this is sexual love. It's what we mean when we say we're going to make love. And people make love, generally speaking, it means fornication. It's a terrible, terrible word, and it never found its way into the New Testament in any way at all, except as a condemnation for sensuality and ungodliness that is created by sexual lust. The second word, philein or philia, on the contrary, signifies for the most part the inclination or solicitous love for friends. Now again, the basic concept here is one of selfishness. I don't make a friend unless I like them. I don't like them unless we agree or we share certain attributes with one another. And so this is a love of, again, very much a love of selfishness. The third one, the word agapen, the Greek finds nothing of the power or magic of Aaron and little of the warmth of philein. Its etymology is uncertain, its meaning weak and variable. But whereas Eros consistently engaged the thinking of poets and philosophers from Homer to Plotinus, agapen hardly ever emerges as a subject of radical deliberation. It is indeed striking that the substantive agape is almost completely lacking in pre-biblical Greek, a love that does not desire, but gives. Man doesn't have any use. Let me rephrase this. Sinful man doesn't have any use for agape love. Because agape love is a love that gives and gives and gives without ever taking or hoping to take. And when we read that God so loved the world, that's the love that he has brought into the world again. Because it was lost. It was lost for a time. The Greek poets are no different from the American philosophers today. The idea of love is an idea of that which makes us happy, that which gives us pleasure. As we noted in a couple of the definitions last week, this word is a purely biblical and ecclesiastic word. It's only used in the Bible. It's only used in writings about the Bible. It expresses ideas previously unknown. Therefore, Greek literature or the Septuagint will not help us to understand. Now, here's basically the disconnect that we need to understand. Because if we're ever going to grasp agape love, if we're ever going to grasp and grow from this selfish idea of love that we were raised with and that we mean when we generally speak it to the love that God wants us to add to our faith, then we've got to understand this basic concept. God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So at the beginning, we had the same emotions as God. When we read God is love, when we read God demonstrates his love in giving his son to die for us and to save us, we are reading about an emotion that we were created and originally had. All of us, before sin entered the world, would have had these same basic emotions as God has. But when sin entered the world, we changed. We became less. We were lost. Sin is the selfishness that allows our lusts to take something that belonged to another. Now, God cannot do that. God cannot take something that belongs to another. He is a God of love, a God of a desire to give, and his essential basic makeup is that he wants what makes us happy. And he wants to be involved in making us happy. Whether we respond or not is completely within us. And so the selfishness that allows my desires to take what rightfully belongs to someone else has destroyed the entire concept of love. That's why Jesus said that the entire Old Testament law and prophets falls under the heading of love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Because every commandment in the law, every commandment in the gospel is simply an explanation of what love actually is. A love we forgot. A love that we left behind. A love that we can't even comprehend. And certainly, it's easy to read about these things. It's very difficult to do them. I can read about the love of God, and I can really appreciate the love of God. But now it's my turn to show unselfish care and concern for others. Now, speaking rhetorically here, it becomes a little more difficult. It becomes a lot more difficult. In our selfish world, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So when we look at God, it's difficult for us to understand how he can have absolute power and yet use that power only in our best interests and never for himself. We just don't see that in this world. It's a selfish world where the more power you have, the more you can take from others. The more power you have, the more you can use others for your own ends. And that's how this world operates and how it's how it's operated for our entire memory. All the way back to the garden. We can't go back beyond that. But we can read about it. So, human love only endures until selfishness arises. Now, I think we all understand that basic concept. When I feel a sense of love and a sense of, you know, I got to quit using I. I got myself in a little bit of a bind last week, so I tend to use my own self, because when I start preaching, all I'm thinking about is what's the best way to get this across to you. And sometimes when I think of the best way to get it across to you, I end up saying something that really shouldn't have been said. And I wanted to make clear that statement about not loving Jeannie, those are things that happened 40 years ago. Nothing like that has happened for decades. But I just drew from it and didn't explain it, and so it came across totally wrong. That was the immature Alan that I was talking about last week, an immature Alan that we've left behind for the most part. Now let's leave it right there. All right, human love only endures until selfishness kicks in. Parents love their children until a selfish need arises, and then suddenly they will use their children or abuse their children or misuse their children. Love in a relationship of a husband and wife is a wonderful relationship until selfishness kicks in and one person wants something and is going to take it, even though by taking it, it's going to hurt the person they say they love. And this has become so commonplace that it doesn't even shock us anymore. It doesn't even shock us that someone can say, I love you, I will die for you, I'll give myself for you, and the next day they're off doing something completely and exactly the opposite. And this is the problem with human love, and it's why Jesus couldn't use it. It doesn't have a counterpart in the spiritual realm, because selfishness leads to the death of love. And we all understand that. I mean, the divorce rate makes it very clear. When people get married, they love each other, and they're going to do everything for each other, and they're going to sacrifice for each other. Then a year passes, and 2 years pass, and suddenly their own selfish desires and their own selfish needs are being impeded and impinged upon by this other person, and suddenly they don't need them anymore. But why don't they need them anymore? They told the person, I need you, and I will give you everything I can for your whole life, and then suddenly I don't need you anymore, and all those promises are gone. And the promises that are made, they are broken, and people are damaged, the children are damaged, and all sorts of terrible things happen, all, quote, in the name of, I will love you forever. And then suddenly, as I say, selfishness comes in. And before Jesus came, that's all love had become. A selfish desire for another that led to help or to hurt at our whims. And brethren, if we don't recognize that in ourselves, if we don't see this problem in ourselves and the way that we relate to the people we love, our friends, our husbands, our wives, our children, our brethren, and so often, as long as selfishness can be kept down, everything flows and everything goes well. But the moment selfishness rears its head, we have fights, we have bitterness, we have divorce, we have betrayals, and all sorts of terrible things that could have absolutely been impossible if the love they proclaimed and said they would have forever had not run into selfishness. And so God had to just demonstrate it before we could even grasp or see it. And so we begin with his demonstration. While we were still without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. Now basically what Paul is saying in verse 7 is there wasn't anything about us to love. There wasn't anything about us that God could say, I need this, I want this, this is something that can bring me pleasure. No, we didn't have anything to bring to God. We were without strength. Verse 7, scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Now, verse 7 is basically the best humanity can produce, and you will find from time to time up someone who will unselfishly give up his own life for another. We say we'll do it. I would die for my wife. Everybody says that. I would die for my husband. Everybody says that. When the opportunity arises, though, that's when it becomes very difficult. And as Paul said, scarcely for a righteous man will one die. And perhaps for a good man, someone would even dare to die. But God went above and beyond that in his own love. And this is the demonstration. This is what Jesus came to reveal, that love is very different from what you call love. Eros is not love. Sexuality, fornication is not making love. It is actually damaging, as Paul said. It is a sin against our own body. It is a sin that destroys the marriage bond. It is a sin that creates such terrible consequences. And yet people call that love. God demonstrates his love, very different from man's love, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Now think about that for a minute. We had nothing. We weren't beautiful. We weren't lovely. We weren't desirable. As God portrayed it to Israel, you were crying in your own blood. There wasn't anything about you when I first met you that would lead me to offer you marriage. But I cleaned you up. And I clothed you and I decked you out in beauty and glory and glory and jewels. And I did all these things for you because I loved you. But not the kind of love that Israel was thinking. And the same thing is true here. God demonstrates his own love toward us. Now, this is a love, as the Greek lexicons we just read, this was a love that was incomprehensible. The philosophers didn't talk about it. The poets didn't talk about it. Nobody understood it. It was impossible to even explain. But God demonstrated it. So the first thing God had to do was show us, I'm different from you. I don't allow selfishness to involve my at all in my decisions. My love is based on your need. My love is based on what I can do for you. My love is based on what you need and what I can do, and I'm going to do what I can for your need, and that's it. And so this is what God means when it says, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world. He certainly could have. We read in Ephesians chapter 2 that the wrath of God is revealed against the ungodliness of the wicked world of which we came from. But God didn't send his Son to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. So we're introduced to agape as the reason why God sent his Son to save us. Now, this is a love that we cannot comprehend, but until we comprehend it, we cannot add it. It's a love that is completely different from anything that we could comprehend or anything that we could mean before we become a Christian. And let me rephrase that, before we become a mature Christian. Because as long as our notions of human love are still within us, selfishness will always come to the forefront, and it's always there. There's always something in it for me. There's always something in it that I'm going to get. Maybe it's the praise of men. Maybe it is just a sense of, I'm a good person because I did this, but there's always some reason why we do what we do until we begin to understand that we need to sweep that away. And we need to replace it with only the care and concern for the needs of other people. Regardless of whether we get any pleasure from it or we get anything from it. Because as Jesus pointed out, if you do it for any other reason, you've received your reward in full. As Jesus points out in the giving of alms and in the praying and fasting, that if we have any other motives, any other selfish motives, any other reasons why we're doing something, then simply to show God our love and devotion to him and to his people, then there's no reward whatsoever. In another passage that deals with the manifestation, in this the love of God was manifested toward us, that God has sent his only begotten Son into the world, that we might live through him. We were dead. We were useless. We had no value whatsoever. That's what hell is for, brethren. Hell is a place where people are sent who are worthless to God and worthless to themselves. They're irredeemable. There's nothing that can be done for them any further. And we were all in that condition until God gave us an escape mechanism. And the reason that he gave us that escape mechanism is love. The love of God was manifested toward us, that God has sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him. Now, he passes over the gory details of Jesus having to be spat upon and beaten and mistreated out of the selfish motives of the Jewish people. And all the Jewish people turned their back on Jesus, and all the Gentiles could care less about Jesus. There wasn't anyone with him when he died on the cross. His disciples had forsaken him. His people had turned against him. And God, at that moment, had to watch and allow this to occur, and it all fell on him. So the love of God was manifested in that God sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him. In this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God loved us like this, we also ought to love one another. Now, every one of these loves here is agape. It's always the unselfish care and concern for the needs of other people. God lives to serve. God lives eternally to manifest this love. And it is such an integral part of his character that we'll read in just a moment that God is love. So the love of God was manifested when Jesus came into the world. We were enemies. There was nothing lovable about us. There was no reason whatsoever for God to lift a finger. We were irredeemable. We were completely worthless. We were broken. We were destroyed. We were damaged. There was nothing except God's love that gave any hope. But because God is a God of love, and again, this is a concept that we have difficulty grasping, and sometimes we look at God and we think about God's love, we're still thinking of it in the realm of human thinking. And so when somebody says, how could God love me? How could God love a sinner like me? There's such a terrible misapplication and misunderstanding about love if we make a statement like that. And yet we make statements like that. God doesn't love me anymore. Well, why doesn't God love you anymore? Because how could God love a wretch like me? Well, there is some truth to that. But the word love doesn't mean what you're saying is how could God want to help me? Because I'm a wretch. Well, that's the whole point of the passages we've just read, is that God did love us at our worst. God loved us before we knew him. God loved us before there was anything about us whatsoever. Once we become a Christian, and I didn't read that verse, but the next verse in Romans 5 said, how much more shall he save us because now we are redeemed? We were irredeemable, but because of Jesus' death on the cross, we became redeemable, and God wanted all men to have that redemption. But those who actually accept it are the ones that God is able to work with and able to help. So this is a love that we need and we seek and we rejoice in. But how often do we really give it? And I'm not talking about somebody we care about and an opportunity to do something nice for them. I'm talking about somebody who has nothing to care about them. We don't know them. They have nothing to offer, nothing to give. What do we feel toward people like that? What are we willing to do for people like that? We just read that one. So, in this, the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. The word manifest, what does that mean? It means bring to the light. It means something that couldn't be seen, couldn't be known, couldn't be understood, couldn't be explained, and suddenly it's brought into the light, and now it's easy to understand and easy to explain. The children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. Now, this is not phileo love. This is the unselfish care and concern that we are to add to our faith. It is above and beyond brotherly kindness. Brotherly kindness still has a sense of belonging, a sense of enjoyment, a sense of selfishness, a sense of appreciation. This love rises above that, and this is the love we're going to give to everyone, even those we couldn't care less about. You understand the difference? I couldn't care less about some of the people I love. You say, well, what does that mean? Well, it means that I can't find anything about them that selfishly or humanly or beneficially that I could receive. They have nothing. I don't like them. I don't like what they do. I don't like how they act. I wouldn't want to be around them. I wouldn't want to spend time with them. But I would do anything for them. And if I could help them, I would. Now, again, that's easy to say, but the children of God are those who have gone back to become like God, and the children of the devil are those who are still selfishly motivated. Everything that most people do is calculated. What's in it for me? If I can find anything in it for me, I'll do it. If there's nothing in it for me, then there's only one thing that would move us to do it, and that is this agape love. And as I said a moment ago, most of us, before we became a Christian, didn't even know that existed. We couldn't think like that. We couldn't act like that because it was beyond our scope of imagination. It was something, I mean, to imagine a God who would be like the God we serve is incomprehensible. I mean, we couldn't ask for a better set of circumstances than to have a God with absolute power and absolute abilities and eternity, and yet he ever lives to bless us. There's no shifting shadow. God is ever living to give blessings, to bless. Ever blessing, ever blessed is how we put it in one of our songs. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love the brethren. He who does not love his brother abides in death. Now, brethren, we've got to back away from this. This is not talking about human love. This is talking about that unselfish love. The love that would get you to go out at 2 o'clock in the morning to help someone who you barely know because they have a need. And this is something that God has manifested, and we need to learn how to do it. Now, here's the transition. We have known and believed the love that God has for us. God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God in him. So we learned it from God. We appreciated it from God. We think about it every first day of the week. We think about the love of Christ and how far he was willing to go to redeem us and to bring us into a situation where we could be lovable. We were unlovable, but God made us lovable. Now that can happen, and that's what we have to understand. We have known and believed the love that God has for us. That's the gospel. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. In this is love, not that we loved him, but that he loved us and gave his son to die for us. So we have, if we're going to add this love to our faith, to our virtue and our knowledge and our self-control and our perseverance and our godliness and brotherly kindness, we've got to learn what it is. We don't know what it is. It's only in the scriptures. You can't see it or taste it or touch it or smell it. It's not in this world. It's only in the world to come. It's only coming back from God. And we have known and believed the love that God has for us. This is why we obeyed the gospel. And God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God in him. So there's a transition that has to occur. A transition from selfishness to unselfishness. A transition from knowing God and appreciating what God did for us, and then turning around and becoming like God and no longer acting like the devil. Because the love of man is primarily a selfish love that makes us the children of the devil. We love him because he first loved us. And so Jesus now can say, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. This is not human love. This is agape love. It's brand new. It could never be given before because Jesus had never come before. And God had never manifested this quality of love before. And we could not comprehend God, and we could not comprehend God's love, and we could not comprehend the extent that God was willing to go in order to save us. Now, once we enjoy that and appreciate that, God has an expectation. He has an expectation that we will take it in, that we will synthesize it, and that we will understand it, and then we will become more like him. And so this is a new, recently formed commandment. Couldn't be given in the law because people didn't understand in the law. You love one another as I have loved you. So we have a new commandment, we have a newly defined word, and we have a new degree. So as Jesus loved us, we are to love one another. As God revealed this agape love to us and explained it to us and revealed it to us and helped us to understand it, go and do likewise. And if we can't grasp this point, we'll stay the children of the devil our whole life. Until we at least can see it. Now, most of us can dimly see it in God and Christ. Sometimes we don't even see it there. Sometimes we still look at God and Jesus with the same emotions we feel, and we think that unless they get something from it, they're not going to move, and that's why I have to give them something and give them something and give them something. So many people have been trained from their youth that the only way people will love us is if we do things to keep that love coming. And that if we do things that won't keep that love coming, they'll stop loving us. And so many children are dealing and struggling with that kind of insecurity. And yet God says, that doesn't even matter to me. It isn't what you can give, it's what I can give that causes me to feel this sense of love. I'm not expecting you to do something to earn that love. I am only manifesting what is an inner part of my character that I'm going to give to you, even though you may think you have nothing to give in return. And that's why Jesus came. Jesus came to his own, and his own did not receive him. Jesus knew coming into the world that even the people that he would work with for 3 years would all forsake him. That he would stand alone on the cross. There would be no one. No one would stand with him. No one would support him. He knew that, but his own love led him to say, I'm still going to do it. Not because they deserve it. They didn't deserve it. We did not deserve what God did for us. There's nothing we could do to deserve what God gave to us. There's nothing, even if we, how did Paul put it? Even if I gave my body to be burned, it wouldn't matter. If I don't have the same love that God has, because I can't earn it, I can't get it, it's something that God has always had. He gave it to us. We lost it. Now we're trying to get back to it. And so Jesus says, I'm going to give you this new commandment. And it's going to take all that you have to be able to fulfill it. Now, the applications that he makes concerning this new commandment are given here. And they're very simple. If you love me, keep my commandments. He who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. And as the Father loved me, I have also loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. What's he saying here? If you love me, you will act in my best interest. You're not keeping my commandments so you can go to heaven. You're not keeping my commandments to keep yourself out of hell. Those are both selfish emotions. Now, I'm not saying they're not a part of the gospel, because they are, but they're not a part of agape love. Agape love keeps the commandments because it's in Jesus' best interest. It keeps the commandments because we're reflecting back to him what he reflected to us. This new commandment that he has reflected to us and he wants us to give to one another is also now to be given to him. So if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. Now, if you don't keep my commandments, I don't care what you say about how much you love me. It is not going to make any difference. He who has my commandments and keeps them is acting in my best interests. And if you are acting in my best interests, then my Father and I will act in your best interest. As the Father loved me, I also have loved you. Abide in my love. Well, how do I do that? Well, I act in his best interests. Now, he's going to act in my best interests, whether I act in his or not. If we deny him, he will deny us. But if we're faithless, he remains faithful because he can't deny himself. He cannot be, he cannot give up this love. But unfortunately, if we don't respond, his love will still end in vain. Yes, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Yes, he sent his Son to die and redeem the irredeemable. But those people who do not respond with his love, who remain the children of the devil, those people will not be redeemed. And they will not receive this best interest that God wanted to give them, because a time comes where that can no longer be done. We reach a point where we can no longer be redeemed. Even though God is a God of love and mercy and he would do anything for us, a time comes where there's nothing more he can do. It is appointed unto man to die. After that comes a judgment. But what we see in these passages, the applications of the new commandment. Let's go back and one more time, just take a quick look at that. I have given you a new commandment. You love one another. And of course, we love him and we love God as he has loved us. By this all men will know you are my disciples if you have agape for one another. This is not philos. This is not phileo. So when we look at this, why do you serve Jesus? Is it because you love him and you want to act in his best interest? Or is it to get something? Are we just bargaining with God? I'm going to give you this much service, so you give me eternal life. And we limit it. I'm only going to give you barely enough to get into heaven. But I'm not going to be like you. I'm not going to make the kind of sacrifices for you that you made for me. And we're always going to hold that attitude until we start comprehending who God is. And that's when it starts permeating. For example, in Ephesians chapter 5, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Well, that's a direct application of John 13. You love one another as I have loved you. So now I'm acting in my wife's best interests in exactly the same way that Jesus and God acted in my best interests. So now I'm taking what I learned from God and I'm giving it to my wife, to my children, to my brethren. And that's what this is all about. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. And everyone who loves him who begot also loves him who is begotten. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and keep his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. Now, what's the point here? I'm acting in God's best interests. I'm manifesting to God, I'm going to make whatever sacrifice I have to make for you because I've become like you. Now, that's a very different way of living than the one we came out of the world with, and the one that I think for many years as new converts, we still hold on to that. I love God because of all the wonderful things he's done for me. And that's why I serve him, because of all the wonderful things that he's done for me. Well, let's leave that behind. Why don't we just serve him? Because it's in his best interest to serve him. And we want to be like him. He didn't love us because we had all of these wonderful qualities that led us to love him. He loved us because God is love. And it's just the way he feels toward everyone under all circumstances. And now we're turning it around. Why don't we love God like that? And why don't we love Jesus like that? And if we can't love God and Jesus, we'll never be able to give this to our fellow man, because it will be too hard. So whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves him who begot also loves him who is begotten. Now, this again is the transition. This is the transition from what I've received from God, and now I'm giving it back to God, and now I'm giving it back to my fellow man. Now, I made a point earlier, and I really want to go back to it. We love getting this from God, but we really struggle giving it to anyone else. There's always calculations. Just watch yourself. Watch yourself as you live your life and as you make sacrifices for people, and watch what's going on in your head. And watch yourself as you're going through this, and try to understand what really are my motivations. Why is it that I make a sacrifice for one person but not for another person? Why is it that I can willingly do one thing, and what you're going to find is, most of the time, it's not agape love. We're still on a bargaining field where we're going to do this in order to get this. And we're going to give this person this because it'll help us to get into heaven. But when can we just strip all that away and just say, like God, I love because you need, and that's all there is. Because of a need that you have, I love, and I'm going to fulfill it. It doesn't matter whether I get anything. Now, that's a step that is very, very difficult. It's one of those marks of maturity. Now, here are the steps. That Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love. Now, we're going to talk about this more in the next week or so, because this passage is crucially important. We know what roots do to the tree. They give it stability and they give it sustenance. We know what a foundation does for a building. And Paul says this is where we have to start. We have to be rooted and grounded in love. And only then will we be able to comprehend the width and length and depth and height to know the love of Christ, which passes understanding. Now, think about the conundrum here. Think about the paradox here. You love one another as I have loved you, and yet Paul says here that love passes knowledge. So, essentially what Paul is saying is that we can never really fulfill the command, because until we can grasp the love of Christ, how are we going to love as he has loved us? And yet, where does it start? It starts with being rooted and grounded in agape love. So we've got to strip away from our mind all notions of sexuality, all notions of pleasure and enjoyment, all notions of selfishness and what's in it for me, and strip all that away and leave ourselves with this basic concept of you have a need and I have to fulfill it. Well, let me take half out there, because that destroys it. You have a need, I live to fulfill it. That's God. That's God's love. You have a need, I live to fulfill it. I am a God of love, of unselfish care and concern for the angels, of unselfish care and concern for humanity, of unselfish care and concern for sinners. We see it in Jesus. You can't make him mad. Now, he will rebuke and he will show strong emotions, but he doesn't get selfishly involved because of love. Now, if we're going to accomplish that, we've got to become rooted and grounded in that love. And then we can be able to comprehend the width, the length, the depth, and the height, and try to comprehend what led Jesus to empty himself, take on the form of a servant, live among sinful men, and allow those sinful men to crucify and put him to death and mistreat him and torture and betray him. What was in it for him? What calculations could he make? If I do this, I'll get this. It doesn't work that way. He already had everything. He had everything before he came into the world. There was only one reason he came into this world. It wasn't to get anything. It was to give. He came to give us hope and salvation and eternal life and redemption and eternal thanksgiving to him for what he did. That's what motivated the Lord. There wasn't anything else. And we've got to strip that away. If we're ever going to truly say, I have agape love, then we've got to strip away that selfishness. And we have to start living for other people instead of for ourselves. Now, when we do that, it's going to change our family. It's going to change our relationships at work. It's going to change the way that we work with one another in the Lord's church. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. Now, it's interesting, if you read the definitions of love in 1 Corinthians 13, you find almost all of these. And that's why verse 13, bearing with one another and forgiving one another, if anyone has a complaint against any, as Christ forgave you, so you must also do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. Because it takes all of these other things and ties them together. Now, I have a few more verses, but we're just about out of time, so I'm not going to finish those verses this evening. I don't want to rush through these things. So we're going to take our time. We're going to move slowly. This is very difficult. It's difficult for me to express it. And brethren, I want you to understand something. While I'm preaching these things, my heart's hurting me as much as your heart's hurting you. Because it's a struggle. These things are hard. It's hard to divorce our selfishness from our very existence. We are people who do things for ourselves. And we give to get. And we calculate. And all of our love is based on what's in it for me. Then we come face to face with Jesus and we come face to face with God. And we realize that that's what sin has made us. And what we used to be and what we're supposed to be is what God is. And so we're now going to sing the song of encouragement. And I know I haven't said anything in this lesson about obeying the gospel. But I have said a lot about what we need to become. And hopefully your conscience has been pricked. If it hasn't, then you just weren't listening. Because no one has this. No one has this perfectly. And we can't. We just don't have the ability to rise above and develop these things. Now we see Paul. Paul shows some very clear indications that he has moved a long way onto that path. But anyway, as we sing the song of encouragement this evening, if there's anyone in the audience who recognizes that something in this sermon has shown them they have a need, take it to God. But if you have a need to bring it to the congregation, you'd like to repent or confess your sins, we give you that opportunity while we now stand and sing.